Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll hear from Pastor Warren Stewart Sr., who's retiring from leading his church after nearly 50 years. And the Gold Cup is coming to the Valley this weekend. We'll preview the soccer tournament's quarterfinal games in Glendale. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
With the help of shock jocks and troll farms, you can fool some of the people some of the time. It takes leadership, competence, and courage to pass a bipartisan budget in divided government.
I can tell you, without the money, those planes are grounded. So if you have an emergency and need air rescue, do not call DPS. Rangers will not respond.
What the governor's staff needs to understand is this is her last chance. This is where we are, folks. We have a very basic budget to keep the lights on.
We want to make sure that we are doing our job and making government a government that works for the people and not the other way around.
Politics doesn't have to be in everything. This is about a team we all love, a team that provides incredible economic development to this state, and a point of pride.
Are you finally ready to admit you lost the 2022 Arizona election?
It saddens me that you are from Arizona and you're okay with
it. That's a yes or no question, Ms. Lake.
It saddens me that you are from Arizona.
I think the answer is no, reclaiming my time.
And with me to talk about budget battles as the fiscal year draws to a close, a new record for gubernatorial vetoes and more, are Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning, Mark.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Chuck, you have been around a few governors in your days.
Yes.
And you've been around a few legislatures and budget situations.
Yeah.
How does this one compare?
Fairly dysfunctional on a epic scale.
All right.
As Mr. Peterson was alluding to.
Charlatans.
It was shocking that, yeah. That he downloaded like that on the Freedom Caucus.
On the House.
Yeah, on the House. Well, and Jake Hoffman in his own chamber.
Fabulous.
And I was just shocked. I mean, Warren is a very conservative Republican, and he's just had it because, you know, the dysfunctional communication that's existed between the House and the Senate and not being on the same page. And, you know, he knows, as we all do. I mean, we go through this every budget cycle with people who are not in reality about if you have a Democratic governor, as Warren said, you have to work with them. It takes 16, 31, and 1. That's
yeah.
The rule. And what he was alluding to is the House's intransigence on that. And your last quote from Mr. Livingston on there was amusing because, well, the governor's going to learn. Well, I think Mr. Livingston has now learned that, you know, it takes the governor's signature.
Stacey, why was it that the House and Senate Republicans couldn't get on the same page?
Basic toddler behavior. If anyone has had a three-year-old, you know, you finish a meal. I want cake. Okay, well, you can have a cookie. We only have cookies. No, I want cake. Nope. You don't get cake. You don't get cake. There are only cookies, and you can only have one. I mean, we were watching mom and dad scold the children in the house in a way that turned out to be pretty entertaining. They just don't. The house did not understand who's going to be signing the ultimate budget.
Well, so Chuck, let me ask you this. Is there, you know, we talk about leadership a lot, and obviously Governor Hobbs has been through a few of these. Senate President Peterson has been through a few of these now. This is House Speaker Steve Montenegro's first session as Speaker. Did that have anything to do with this?
It had everything to do with it. It had everything to do with it. He's being chased by his Freedom Caucus in his own body. You know, he's got 7 or 8 people in his caucus that are Freedom Caucus members, and they generally did not support him for Speaker. And so for some reason, he felt obliged to let them go, let them do their thing. And there is wisdom in that. I mean, I remember talking to Rusty Bowers back in the day, and Rusty had this theory about the budget. He goes, you got to let the dogs run, Chuck. You got to let the dogs run. Get all this venom out of them. You know, maybe the mistake could have been that the Senate didn't vote on the House budget when they sent that over there. and send that up to the governor and let her veto it. Maybe that was the point in which the train didn't stay on the track. But for whatever reason, the House and the Senate were not on the same page. And his speakership was being challenged from within.
Well, and I guess you could make the argument then, under that logic, that the way that Montenegro handled this maybe was the right way, right? Because he let the Freedom Caucus members pass two budgets that they wanted. The Senate eventually took them up. The governor vetoed them. And then they ended up with the budget that they probably would have ended up with in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, there's an argument to be made for that, that he had to do what he had to do, back into the Rusty Bowers analogy. Yeah. Let the dogs run. Let them get their energy out, you know, and then face reality. He didn't want to be the point. You know, the Senate was trying to be that reality point of saying, well, we've negotiated this. You didn't choose to negotiate. So there was some ego friction going on there.
Stacey, do you buy into the argument that since this budget had both bipartisan support and opposition, something that, you know, it was a budget that both Democrats and Republicans, some of them liked, some of them each hated, means it was maybe a good compromise?
That's exactly what it was. And it's always harder. This sounds counterintuitive, but it's harder when there's a surplus than when mm-hmm. there's a deficit.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out what priorities get first slot is difficult.
You can't just say no to everybody.
Exactly. And when we're looking at what those priorities were that the governor and the Senate had negotiated, law enforcement raises, DPS, firefighters raises, I mean, those were really important pieces of policy that needed to move forward. So I think that those two, the administration and the Senate, did a great job delivering for Arizonans. And I think the House really took its toddler tantrum to the extreme.
Were you surprised at all to see the amount of public sniping? I mean, obviously, there's going to be friction all the time between different politicians and even between the House and Senate. But this one was very public.
Well, I was surprised, and I did not have on this year's bingo card me retweeting in support of Peterson's chief of staff, who detailed the daily rundown.
He sent out a thread on yep. Twitter X about like how it all went down between the governor's office, the House, and Senate.
Setting the record straight. And I probably agree with nothing that in policy that gentleman recommends. But that's how he detailed that exchange was accurate.
The most amusing part was Livingston calling Peterson a rhino in a tweet. And then David's wife sends out a defend my husband tweet in the middle of it. And I'm like, okay, we're off the farm here. This is not, not productive.
That's never good.
Do both of you think that at the end of the day, the fact that we're, 4 days from the end of the fiscal year, is that what did it? Is that what broke it? Broke the logjam?
Yeah. And I think that finally the Senate just said, okay, we're going to let him do this little, as Stacey would say, this little tantrum, as Rusty would say, let the dogs run.
By putting the budgets up on the board.
Yeah, put them up, set them up, let her veto them, let her be the bad guy, and then get back to business. Today, I think right after this show, about 10 o'clock, they'll be concurring.
After they listen to this, of course.
Sure, they're all glued.
All 90 of them,
So they'll go down and concur, and the budget will go up to the governor, and we'll have avoided the shutdown.
Stacey, what lessons do you take away from this? Because these groups still have one more year. I mean, whatever's left of this session, right. Probably not that much. But then a whole nother year together. What, based on these last couple of weeks, what do you take away looking forward on?
Well, we have an administration that understands how this works. We've got a former House Minority Leader in Chad Campbell as the governor's chief. We've got the governor herself who served in the legislature. They understand how the sausage gets made. And certainly the Senate president does as well. So the House is going to have to play catch up and really do their work on how to be influential, perhaps not on a Twitter fight, but in the actual policymaking that puts this package together.
Chuck, what do you take away from these last couple of weeks? I'm specifically curious about the influence of the Freedom Caucus. You alluded to them, because it seems as though they were able to delay things and kind of gum up the works. But at the end of the day, they weren't really able to have the kind of influence on the final product that I would imagine they wanted.
Yeah. Historically, this would have been solved at the staff level. There would have been some mutual respect shared on both sides, and it fell apart for whatever reason. Michael Hunter's not down there anymore.
Former Senate Chief of Staff.
Former House
Chief of Staff.
House Chief of Staff. experience. I mean, worked with us in the Brewer administration, worked in the House before that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just a lot of experience in somebody like that. This is the first session without Michael. So I really look at it as a staff communication breakdown.
Is this something that you expect to carry over?
No, no. Okay. I think they'll figure it out. They'll figure it out. They don't want to go through this. I mean, they don't want to have to deal with this circus that they had to go through. And so, you know, they just got to figure out how to run the circus.
Stacey, let me ask you about the new, I don't know if this is a record that Governor Hobbs wants to set, but she broke her own record for the number of vetoes. The caveat here is that there were two budgets, which each contained, 14 or 15 bills?
It's over a dozen.
So you get a big chunk just in that, and she vetoed two of them. But, you know, her first year, she had a lot of vetoes. Second year, fewer. This year, the most. I mean, is there anything to take away from that?
So we're going to see some of the vetoes come back as zombie referrals. I expect to have a big, long ballot again.
Ballot referrals.
Ballot referrals. There's, seven, 10 that have already been filed as referrals. So voters are going to make decisions on some of this. But some of the bills that she vetoed were objectively terrible, like re-legalizing silencers, making silencers great again. You know what's worse than a mass shooting? Not hearing one start. I mean, this is terrible. Like, of course she should veto silencers. There was a bill that didn't allow for cities to reduce public safety funding. Public safety was against that. I mean, we've been through a recession. We understand how budgets work. The Arizona Police Association asked her to veto that. I mean, we're talking about some really strange things that the legislature popped up to her.
Yeah, Chuck, what do you mean? I mean, you've worked with a couple governors.
Yeah.
They don't have this record.
No, but this legislature's got a track record of sending HCRs of stuff that
ballot
goes
referrals
to the ballot.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
And she's 100% right. I think they believe that helped them last time. They had a bunch of stuff on the ballot that, you know, they could narrate and they could sell to their base, and that they believe that helped them. So one of those was defeated last night in the House. They tried to put up a photo radar ban for the ballot, and it did not muster the 31 votes necessary to get over the finish line. But at the end of the day, the bigger story here is, you know, it really comes down to the governor. I mean, so she's going to campaign. That's going to be her message. These people are crazy. You know, I'm your backstop. I'm your here. Is that enough? Is that enough in the age of Trump to say, is that enough to convince voters to say, hey, I'm going that way because I'm scared of that? Or does somehow the Republican primary end up generating some ideas about how we move forward that she will have to react to? I think that's the really big question going forward. You know, you have big water issues in the state.
Yeah.
We have public education funding issues going on in the state, as we always do.
Mm-hmm.
We have mental health funding issues going forward in the state, as we always do. You have, you know, local autonomy on zoning and housing going forward on what we need as a state. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, it's not a good enough answer to just say, well, I vetoed. You know, you got to lead at some point. Somebody's got to figure out how to lead down there.
Are you suggesting a campaign might be about policy?
Maybe. That's why I'm now 63, Mark, and maybe why I don't do this anymore.
Chuck's getting soft. Look at this.
All right. That is the apparently soft Chuck Coughlin. Also joined by Stacey Pearson. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week, Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategies and Chuck Coughlin of High Ground. Stacey, let me start with you on what has been known as the Diamondbacks bill. After a lot of negotiation, a lot of delay, this bill is headed to the governor. The conventional wisdom is that she will sign it. It's a way for the D-backs to basically, the bill will divert some money, some tax revenue, to a district, the stadium district, to help the Diamondbacks refurbish Chase Field. Is this seems like one of those, again, we talked about the budget, has bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. But this is one that it seemed like the governor was fairly engaged on and really trying to come up with some kind of deal on.
For sure. And in full disclosure, my business partner was one of the lead lobbyists on this. And my former business partner really likes baseball. so that might have something to do with it. But the truth is, we can't rewind how the stadium was built to begin with. Mm-hmm. The taxpayers own it. There's no time machine. We can't go 30 years ago and decide we didn't want to own it. The taxpayers don't want to own it. And now we have an albatross with no air conditioning at the corner of Main and Main getting into downtown Phoenix, and taxpayers needed to fix it. And regardless of whether or not you care about baseball or think that public financing should even be on the table, if the baseball team moved away, we'd have to tear it down. There's still an expense. This still was a building that taxpayers owned. So you had to decide whether or not you want baseball to be played in it or you want to take it down.
Well, Chuck, that was an argument that a lot of supporters of this bill set. You heard over and over, this is a building that the public owns, so we should take care of it.
Yeah, hats off to Jeff Wininger, who had the courage to sponsor the
Agreed.
Bill in the House.
State representative, yeah.
Yeah. You know, he sponsored it based on that thematic. And I got it. I mean, I was around when Mary Rose got shot.
Yeah.
When Jim Bruner lost his campaign for Congress because he supported the baseball stadium. But the basic fact is, Stacey's right, this was a taxpayer-built building, and we'd walked away from the maintenance of the facility and the obligation to sustain that. $250 million back in the day, probably a half a billion today or more. And so we have an investment. So what do you do with the investment? I mean, that's a brass tacks question. I was happy to see Mr. Wininger support it. I was delighted to see the veteran legislator, J.D. Mesnard, dig in, because I think he's probably the only person in the Capitol that would have been capable of getting that deal done.
Is this a tough one optically because of what the building is? It's a baseball stadium run by, you know, one of the richest owners in baseball.
Politically active.
Who's politically active.
And you have, wife is politically active.
Yeah. And you have players playing there who all make millions, you know, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. As a taxpayer, it seems like it wouldn't be too much of a stretch to say, why don't they pay for it? Why am I paying for it?
Just not happening in anywhere in major league sports today. Vegas is building a brand new stadium at public money. It's a luxury.
Utah has.
It's a luxury that if you want as a community, which means that you're now part of the elite communities in the country, if you want this, then you got to figure out how to host them. And as you said, most of those players are making hundreds of millions of dollars. Now their income tax dollars are going to go to the stadium. And so you can make that argument that it's a self-contained economic enterprise, which generates additional economic enterprise around it.
Stacey, another bill going up to the governor is the so-called Ag to Urban bill. This is one that would essentially allow developers to buy the water rights of farms if the farmers decide to sort of hang it up and not run their farms anymore. And supporters say it's a way to build more homes, get, you know, help deal with the housing crisis while also saving water. There are some water folks who say it's not really going to have that kind of effect. But one of the things that struck me was that a number of supporters were comparing this bill to the 1980 Groundwater Management Act, saying this is the most significant piece of water legislation since that time. I'm curious if you agree with that.
So I absolutely do. And this was not an easy piece of policy to pass.
It's been a couple
either.
Years.
Yeah,
in
it's
making.
Been multiple years, right? But alfalfa objectively uses more water than a house. I mean, it's just how this works. And so we know the direction farming is going, and it's not the little guys anymore. They're all being bought out by conglomerates, and we know that housing's a crisis, and it's the top of mind for voters and top of mind for folks trying to find a place to live. So this it certainly was complicated policy, and it was nice to see it get done.
2 years ago, Dave Roberts, who used to be the head of SRP Water, wrote a piece in the Arizona Republic that said, "Hey, as we retire these farms, we should give the credit to a developer, some credit, not all of it, but
the
we should
credits.
Give some credits to a developer to be able to use some of that water, because we all know housing uses less water than ag." That makes perfect sense. I mean, it does make perfect sense. That's what was done here. It makes perfect sense. The governor up to this point had been attempting to leverage the legislature to do something about rural groundwater. Mm-hmm. because that's a problem still. You have 80% of the state has no groundwater regulation. So you, Mark, are an industrial farmer. You come in, you drop a 5,000-acre well next to Stacy and me, who is our little 10-acre property, and you start pumping 5,000 gallons a minute. Stacy and my well goes dry. We're SOL. We don't have anything to say about that. That's not just. That is wrong. We've been unable to, up till now and through now, to get through the agriculture, the realtors, and the ranchers. Those are fairly significant entities down at the legislature.
Yeah.
And most significantly, Gail Griffin, who's the natural resources policy chairman, to find some compromise on that.
Yeah.
It is disappointing to me that, you know, I understand why she did it. I understand that it's an election. It's coming up on an election year, and I got to have these people be happy with me. But I would have preferred her to hold the line until next year and see if we'd gotten something finally done on this.
On rural.
I would agree with you that it's a big water change. The biggest water change, if we can get it done, would be this Groundwater Management Act.
All right. Yeah. Guys, a few minutes left. I want to ask you about what seems like a fairly decent-sized snafu coming from the Maricopa County Recorder's Office. And, Chuck, I'll start with you with the caveat that you do some work with the County Board of Supervisors.
We do.
So this was a letter that went out to, I think, 83,000 voters in Maricopa County, essentially telling them that they were going to be removed from the active voting list if they did not respond, when in fact they should have gotten letters that said they were part of this MVD situation where they didn't prove proof of citizenship when they initially registered to vote and shouldn't have been voting on the entire ballot. It seems, if nothing else, confusing for, you know, tens of thousands of voters in this county.
Yeah. It's disappointing that they are not acting in concert. Mr. Heap has been picking a partisan fight.
The recorder.
Yes. With the Republican board for some time. So in defense, there was a significant change in policy at the end of Mr. Richard's term, where he gave back to the board a bunch of responsibilities. Mr. Heap objected to that. Tom Galvin, the county chairman of the Board of Supervisors, said, okay, let's talk about it. Let's work out an agreement to do that. And then, you know, Mr. Heap hired a political operative who's not known for getting along with anybody. And now we get stuff like this that tries to make everybody look bad. You know, the board has been trying to do what it's been trying to do in the best interest of all the voters of Maricopa County. I would suggest maybe Mr. Heap is being a little bit more partisan minded about that. And now you have these squabbles which spill over into actually how to do your job. And it's disappointing that there isn't clarity about the letter that you suggested, that, as Stacy alluded, this has been going on for some time. We could just tell people, hey, this is the issue. This is how you remedy the issue.
Yeah, Stacey, very briefly, and the recorder's office is saying this was a printing error.
Oh, come on. you have one job as a recorder, which is to record things accurately, be it votes, be it documents, whatever it is. And I just want to remind folks that Justin Heap at the legislature was a tinfoil hat wearing election denier. And what we're seeing here is an extension of that platform. I mean, the guy truly thought that aliens or space lasers could get into our machines. It's insanity.
Well, I guess we have to leave it there.
I'm not sure what to call that, but we'll
leave it there. Stacey Pearson, Chuck Hoffman, thanks to you both.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why this year's Gold Cup has a different feel to it. We'll hear what to expect at tomorrow's matches in Glendale. But first, when Dr. Warren H. Stewart Sr. first came to Phoenix nearly 50 years ago from New York City, his plan was to stay for a few years and then go back. He'd been in school there and figured he'd get some experience in the Valley before heading back east. But now, after 48 years leading the First Institutional Baptist Church of Phoenix, Stewart says he's glad God didn't answer that prayer and that he didn't leave Arizona. Stewart is the church's senior pastor. He'll be giving his final sermon this Sunday before retiring. He's been a leader in the civil rights movement in Arizona, including in the fight for the state to establish a holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Stewart stopped by the studio recently to talk about his nearly five decades here, but we started with why he's decided to hang it up now.
Well, I've been working at the same address for 48 years. And as I tell people, well, Pastor, why are you tired? I am tired. I am tired. I love pastoring. I love people. I love working in the community, but I am tired.
What does retirement look like for you?
R-E-S-T first. I want to rest first. But also, I have a couple of books in my head I want to get out that I haven't had time to put onto paper. And at this season in my life, I want to mentor. I want to use my experiences or allow those to be used by other leaders coming on. I strongly support what is called servant leadership, where you're out for to help other people, not just yourself. And so I want to be able to maybe advise and counsel and mentor other leaders coming on.
You mentioned that you have been almost five decades at the same address.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, when you look around this city and this community, a lot has changed over those 50
goodness.
Years.
Oh, my goodness. When I came here, there was one freeway, the Black Canyon Freeway. Yes. And so I think there are about 500,000 people in Phoenix proper then. Now it's the fifth largest city in the nation.
What to you stands out as the biggest change, maybe the biggest change that you've seen from the pulpit at your church?
Well, Phoenix has become more diverse. The people of color population has continued to grow, even African Americans. But this city, this state has really changed over the last half century.
How
for
so?
The better, I believe.
Yeah.
You know, we get a lot of bad press, or we've gotten a lot of bad press over the years because of who has been in leadership in government in the past. But I often tell people, well, how can you live in Arizona? I said, well, in Arizona, you can live where you want. If you can pay the mortgage, you can live where you want. You can marry who you want. You can do just about what you want in Arizona. And so don't let the negative press of a few political leaders make you think that the whole state is like that.
Do you think some of the politics maybe overshadowed what was going on sort of below the surface here?
Yes. I mean, during the whole Martin Luther King Jr. holiday fight, I mean, we became the Alabama of the 1980s. But that is not the existence, the segregation like they had in Alabama. Never. It didn't exist here. But again, because the political leadership, former Governor Evan Meekum and others who just kept disrespecting and saying Martin King doesn't need his own holiday, it gave the image that the whole state thought like that.
I want to ask you about that because you had a big role in trying to get a Martin Luther King Jr. holiday approved in Arizona. When you look back on that time now, like what do you remember? What comes to mind for you?
Well, what we had to do, Mark, we had to educate, enlighten, and inspire Arizonans. Now, even though President Reagan signed into law the federal holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., some of us were naive to think that, well, if a Republican president signed it into law, the Republican state legislature here will follow their leader. That did not happen. Because what we found out that many people in Arizona, non-black people, thought that the King holiday was a black holiday. And we were even told, as we were fighting, well, there are only 3 or 4% of you here, so we don't need a holiday, a black holiday here. And so we had to enlighten, educate, and inspire people that what George Washington was to this nation in the 18th century, leading the Revolutionary War, what Abraham Lincoln was, fighting the Civil War over slavery and keeping the nation together in the 19th century, that Martin King was that kind of leader, revolutionary leader, for nonviolence on behalf of liberty and justice for all, trying to get this nation in the 20th century to practice what we preach.
It sounds like, and based on history, it sounds like that was not the easiest lesson to get across at that time.
No, not here in Arizona. I mean, it took, it took certainly 6.5 years from May 18th, 1986, when Governor Babbitt, then Governor Babbitt, signed the executive order for King Holiday in the pulpit of the First Institutional Baptist Church. I was the pastor there then. And then Governor Evan Meekum rescinded it in January of 1987. So from 1986 to 1992, we had to fight for a holiday. It was passed in the legislature, two different versions, overturned by referendum, put on the ballot in 1990. Both propositions were defeated. Then we tried it one more time, and this time was a winner.
So you referenced, you know, some of the press that Arizona's gotten over the years. And obviously, you know, the NFL took the Super Bowl away from the Phoenix area during that time. I wonder if you see any comparisons to another major time when Arizona was getting bad press. That was a little more than a decade ago when the governor signed SB 1070, then Governor Jan Brewer, and there was talk of maybe Arizona losing major events. There was talk of boycotts and things like that. Do you see parallels, or are those two different things to you?
Very much so. Okay. I was involved and have been involved in the immigration fight since 2010 and beyond. I mean, because I saw it as a justice fight. And so I had no challenges moving into and fighting alongside my brown brothers and sisters and others who supported common sense immigration reform. And we were so close. I served for 3 or 4 years as the chair of the National Immigration Forum out of Washington, D.C., and we were right there with the gang of eight senators, four senators, Republican, four Democrats, both of our senators, Flake and McCain, and yet pockets of power in the United States Congress torpedoed comprehensive immigration reform, and that's why we're having the problem we're having now.
So I'm curious, when you look around right now, both in Arizona and maybe to an extent around the country, where do you think we are in terms of race relations compared to where we were when you started this job?
I am very concerned that because of what's coming from the White House and the complicity of the controlling party in the Congress, they are allowing a reversal of civil rights. I mean, getting rid of diversity, equity, and inclusion, renaming military bases after Confederate leaders, outlawing teaching history of people of color in our schools, that is very dangerous. I tell people, we can't complain and comply. We must engage in courageous resistance, whatever that means. We must not allow this to happen. And if that means going back to marching in the streets that people have been doing, even nonviolent civil disobedience, we need to get the message out that America will not go in reverse when it comes to race relations.
So I guess this kind of brings us back to where we started in terms of now that you're going to be retiring. It doesn't sound, though, that you're looking to necessarily retire from this fight, from this issue.
No, I'm retiring from the day-to-day responsibilities of being a senior pastor of First Institutional Baptist Church. I may have more time to be out there fighting for liberty and justice for all.
All right. That is Dr. Warren H. Stewart, senior pastor of the First Institutional Baptist Church of Phoenix. He'll be retiring after nearly 50 years in that job. Dr. Stewart, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Bless you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Glendale will play host to a pair of quarterfinal matches tomorrow in the Gold Cup, a soccer tournament featuring teams from North and Central America. In the first game, Panama will take on Honduras, while Mexico and Saudi Arabia will play in the second game. Saudi Arabia was invited to play in this version of the tournament. The Gold Cup takes place every 2 years and is put on by CONCACAF, which is the Confederation of North, Central America, and Caribbean Association Football. In the other quarterfinal games, Canada will face Guatemala in one match, while the U.S. plays Costa Rica in the other. Those games are in Minneapolis. With me to talk about the tournament and preview the games at State Farm Stadium in Glendale is John Arnold, a soccer reporter who writes the Getting CONCACAF newsletter. And John, if one exists, what has been the overarching theme of this tournament so far?
Well, I mean, I feel like the Gold Cup is always this celebration of soccer in North America, Central America, and the Caribbean. But unlike many continental championships that rotate host sites, the Gold Cup always takes place in the U.S. And a huge part of that is the many diaspora communities that we have in the U.S. It is very easy to find large groups of Mexican fans who want to go to soccer matches, but also Salvadoran fans and Honduran fans and Guatemalan fans, and even some fans of the Caribbean teams that get really good support in the U.S. Whereas if you took, you know, this tournament to Costa Rica or Canada or maybe even an island somewhere in the Caribbean, you likely wouldn't have that fan support for as many of the teams. The big kind of narrative, I guess, this year, if there's been a thread, is that we've seen some of that, but not as much as we're used to seeing. You know, Mexico fans still are turning up to the stadiums. Mexico is still a very well-supported team. But amid this political moment that we're living in, and especially in Los Angeles, where the first match took place, and that was right in the midst of, it was, you know, Mexico's match was the same day as the No Kings protests. It feels different. It feels very subdued in the stands. The tailgating atmosphere beforehand is usually a very big party vibe. I feel like that's been dampened. You know, you can still find people listening to music, smoking meats, drinking a beer. But I think for the most part, some of the vibrancy has kind of been sucked out of this tournament. The other thing that's going on is there's another soccer tournament happening in the United States this summer.
Yeah.
There were games in LA, there were games in Seattle. Most of the games are East Coast, but I do think there's also a level of, I would call it football fatigue, where the U.S. has become sort of this ATM for, you know, I mentioned, hey, there's big fan groups for all these different countries. In the same way, there's big fan groups for Premier League teams and La Liga teams and even teams from Argentina and Brazil. And I think they've come over here often for the tours. And at some point, fans are only able to go to so many matches. They're only going to spend so many dollars. And I think you're seeing some of that as well. So, you know, maybe not the best sign for people trying to get excited for the quarterfinals in Glendale, but something to be aware of, that it just doesn't seem like this tournament maybe has had the vibrancy and resonance with fans that maybe past editions of the Gold Cup has had, even though we thought this was going to be such a great tournament 1 year ahead of the FIFA World Cup taking place here.
Right, absolutely. Well, so you mentioned the games coming up in Glendale on Saturday. There's Panama versus Honduras, then Mexico versus Saudi Arabia. You mentioned the Mexican fans often show up, and you would assume in a place like Arizona, which has a lot of Mexican soccer fans, there will be a lot of those fans at State Farm Stadium. How do you see the games themselves shaking out?
Well, Mexico against Saudi Arabia looks like a bit of a mismatch. Saudi Arabia is the guest team, invited another sort of political conversation. Qatar was the previous guest. Now with the 2034 Men's World Cup taking place in Saudi Arabia, they're already trying to ramp up their investment and kind of win over hearts, if not minds. But they haven't been a very good team on the field, to be honest. The Asian qualification just took place, and they came into the U.S., I think, a little tired. They're not good in the attack. All that to say that Mexico comes in as a huge favorite, and you would think, you know, most analysts would expect Mexico to have a relatively easy time and send the L3 fans home happy. The other game, I think, is pretty intriguing because Panama has established itself as the giant of Central America. They've made the last two important CONCACAF finals, both in this year's Nations League and then the Gold Cup in 2023. They're missing a number of key players, but Honduras hasn't really shown that they can compete. But at the same time, Panama has a target on their back from some of these smaller teams that want to knock off the giant of Central America. So I think there's going to be maybe more drama on the field in that game and probably a much better atmosphere for the second.
So I want to ask you about the political situation ahead of, as you referenced, the World Cup that will be co-hosted by the U.S., Mexico, and Canada coming up. And obviously there won't be any games in that World Cup here in Glendale, but do you think that will still be playing a role? We, of course, can't see the future and know what's going to be happening at that point, but does the vibe seem to be that what we're seeing in terms of, you know, fans showing up and the atmosphere at some of the games, does that seem like a harbinger for what might be coming up next year?
I think it's impossible to separate the political situation with a global event like the World Cup. You could argue that maybe outside of the Olympics, which are also coming to this country, there's no event more global than the World Cup, the Men's World Cup. And this is the biggest one ever, with the field being expanded for more teams. I think that the vibe will shift both because of the politics and because of kind of the knock-on effects. What I mean by that is I've been fortunate to be at World Cups, and you have these huge, huge traveling fan groups for every team. I think in the U.S., people want to see games. I live in Dallas where there are 9 matches being planned, and everyone is telling me, I don't care if it's an unattractive matchup. I don't care if it's without, you know, disrespecting these random countries like Bolivia versus Senegal. I'm going to be there. And I do think that's what's going to happen in the U.S. is the stadiums will fill. But in the past, maybe it's filled with Bolivians or Senegalese. And I think this time around, it'll fill with American fans who want to see what's going on in their backyard. That isn't a problem necessarily, and FIFA will probably still get the same amount of revenue, but then you don't have thousands and thousands of screaming and chanting Bolivians. You have people who are just there for the show. So I definitely think it will affect the atmosphere at the World Cup. And I'm also worried about just generally a team like Haiti, who's in this Gold Cup right now, allowed into the country despite Haiti being on Trump's travel bans. There are exceptions for high-level competition that the players, their families, and staff can get into the country. But even a country like Iran, which is qualified, also on a list, there's a huge number of soccer fans who want to travel to see their team and just wouldn't be able to get in as the situation stands. So I think it really will shift. And those teams are going to be at huge disadvantages through no real fault of their own, you know, with anything they've done on the field or even in their own personal lives. So I think that's something to keep an eye on. And I think it's impossible to imagine the 2026 World Cup not being affected by what's happening now and what will be happening next year in American politics.
Interesting. All right. So crystal ball time. The final has happened. Which of the countries that's still in it is lifting the Gold Cup trophy?
I still think that Mexico has the strongest team. I think they have shown on the field why they've gotten to this point, why they're the reigning Gold Cup holders. And the U.S. has just a few too many doubts for me. I do think the U.S. will make the final, but I think they'll fall there to Mexico. And it'll be L3 again, sort of solidifying themselves as the best team, not just in North America, but the entire CONCACAF region. And one of the best teams in the Americas. Again, you know, we talked about this tournament as being the buildup. Hey, what's 2026 going to look like? It's so important with all three of these North American teams wanting to have their best ever tournament. I think Mexico will get the good vibes going into next year.
All right, we'll see what happens. That is John Arnold, a soccer reporter, also writes the Getting CONCACAF newsletter on Substack. John, good to talk to you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Christopher Rivas is a playwright, author, podcaster, and actor. He's also the current artist in residence at ASU Gamage, where he's been working on a theater piece called How to Get Free. It's billed as a 3-part immersive performance ritual that tackles the human condition head-on, revealing how contemporary life bears striking parallels to the enduring curses of Sisyphus, Tantalus, and Narcissus. Rivas also described it as a sort of therapy session for America. It picks up on some themes Rivas has explored previously in his book and podcast series, Brown Enough. This evening, there will be a sneak peek of the still-in-progress How to Get Free at the ASU Mix Center. When my co-host Sam Dingman spoke with Rivas in the spring, Rivas mentioned he sees art as something that can wake us up and inspire people to use their voices.
Tell me a little bit about what you mean by art galvanizing people on a grander scale. Like, what do you envision when you think about that?
Oof. liberation. What do I envision? I envision big things. I know what my book has done. I know what my plays have done. I know what even the podcast has done to heal people in a small ways. Like when I get a message that someone says, I used to let people call me Angela, but my real name is blank. You know, I've stopped straightening my hair because I listened to this. I broke up with my partner because of this. That's real too. That's change. That's powerful. I get a ton of messages of people, you know, taking the steps to enact change for their own healing, their own joy, their own freedom. And so when I imagine on a larger collective scale, if someone in Arizona comes to see How to Get Free in November, I imagine a room full of people leaving the space different than when they came in, with a little more spaciousness inside them to see their actual place in the world and to see other people. and maybe they care for other people more. And I do believe if you care for someone else a little bit more, if you let someone else into your life a little bit more, that has a ripple effect.
Thank you for sharing that. I feel like that is such a lovely, specific example that doesn't get talked about enough when we talk about the potential for art to create change. Is, I think, skeptics of that sometimes look at that as, oh, what? Somebody's going to go see a play or listen to a protest song or something, and then what, call their congressperson? And sure, maybe they'll do that. But it seems to me it's so much more about what you're describing, that someone has a very personal reaction to something that they see in art, and all of a sudden they make a fundamental change.
And art is so cool because if you go to therapy because you want to be happier, you have to be prepared to do the work. There's a lot of people listening to this right now who go to therapy and they know what they're going to talk about. If you know what you're going to talk about already, you're not really like allowing the work to happen. You know, you've came with the script. In a relationship, you kind of can be taken by surprise. And that's like the beauty of relationships. Like a person can really see you if you let them. But art, man, you can walk into a museum, be bored out of your mind, look at a painting and start crying. And you don't know why. Right? You can go to a play and you're like, I didn't even want to be here right now. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, you want to call this person and change your life.
Right.
You want to go travel. You want to quit your job. You want to care about somebody. Art can find the cracks in you, in between the armor that you didn't know existed, and make them wider.
Right. It like plucks a string you didn't even know was on your 100%. Instrument.
100%. Yeah. That was an excerpt from an interview that originally aired in May between Gamage Artist-in-Residence Christopher Rivas and my co-host Sam Dingman. You can catch a sneak peek of How to Get Free at the ASU Mix Center tonight at 6. And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. But before you get too busy with the weekend, don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. You can also follow the show on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.